Glad you're here this morning. We're going to be in continuing in the book of Exodus this morning. Today's our last study in that's primarily in Exodus. Just a reminder to everybody, Wednesday we're getting into part two of this study, which will be in the book of Leviticus. That will be part two of your workbook. You can pick that up back in the back on your, if you haven't done that already, be sure to pick that up on the way out. You can also download that from the class tracker section of the website. That's posted there, whatever you prefer. And we'll be spending a few lessons in Leviticus, and then at the end, a handful of lessons in the book of Numbers. We're not going to be covering all of these books from front to back, just hitting some high points, especially the book of Numbers. We're just going to hit a few high points from it. We're going to talk today a little bit about the priesthood. We talked Wednesday about the tabernacle, some of its furnishings, some of its ordinances. We're going to see more of that in Leviticus because Leviticus has a lot to do with the sacrificial system and the role of the priests in Israel. So we'll talk about that in due course. But we're going to talk about a handful of things concerning the priesthood today, because this is a very important role in the law of Moses, in Israel's history, and it is a very important connection, as we will see today, to the gospel, especially in the book of Hebrews. We're gonna make some connections there. So somebody tell me, what is a priest? Okay, all right. A mediator between people and God. That's a good definition of that. So what does a priest do? Well, okay, he mediates between people and God. All right, next question. In all through ancient history, all through biblical history, even pagan cultures generally had a priestly class. The idea was that those priests in some way were intermediaries between the people and the various gods that were worshipped. And you have a priestly class, a priestly order set aside in Israel too. Just as a reminder, what tribe do the Israelite priests come from? All right, so the tribe of Levi. What family within the tribe of Levi do they come from? All right, from Aaron's family, Aaron the brother of Moses. It's going to be his descendants who serve as the high priest and the priesthood generally. The rest of the tribe of Levi are going to have very important responsibilities. We're going to look at that just briefly along the way. They have responsibilities with regard to the transportation of and maintenance of the tabernacle and all kinds of things like that. The priests come from the tribe of Levi, from the family of Aaron. Aaron is going to serve as the very first high priest. And in chapter 28, we read a little bit about that. Again, we're just kind of summarizing today. So if you wanted a highly detailed discussion of the priesthood and the garments and all, I hate to disappoint you, you're not getting that today. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But we read about Aaron and his sons. Verse 1, his sons are Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. Nadab and Abihu are going to figure very prominently in the story when we get to Leviticus chapter 10, and not in a good way. In fact, I'll just go ahead and tell you that it's going to end up being Eleazar and Ithamar who are the descendants of Aaron, through whom most of the high priests are going to come from then on. We'll look at the reasons for that, what happens, and all these things are going to happen in pretty rapid succession chronologically. And chapter 28 describes chapter 28 and 29 describe the consecration period for these men in serving as priests, and also the garments that were made for them in serving in their priestly role. Aaron's high priestly garments are described in great detail in verses 4 through 39 of chapter 28. And then starting in verse 40, his son's more ordinary priestly garments are described as well. Just a couple of things to talk about that. And here's one artist's rendering of, kind of what the high priestly garments would have looked like. Let's talk about a couple of the features there. because so many facets of his high priestly garb, which he didn't wear all the time, but wore in the carrying out of a lot of the particular functions that were his. Two onyx stones on the shoulders engraved with the names of the tribes of Israel. On the breastplate, 12 stones, one for each tribe, again imprinted with the names of the tribes of Israel. As a reminder that what he is there to do is mediate on behalf of this particular nation or family of people, the Israelites. On his headdress, a gold plate with the inscription, "Holy to the Lord." And that's an inscription that ends up being, that's the defining inscription of the temple later on. Just a reminder that Israel, not just the priests, but Israel entirely, is a nation that's set apart to God, and that its people are supposed to maintain holiness. Little preview, when we look at Leviticus starting Wednesday night, you're going to see that idea of holiness a lot. And you're going to see it applied not just with regard to the priesthood, although there's going to be a lot of focus on them, but to the nation in general. And the idea of holiness applied to the sacrifices and the vessels of the tabernacle, but particularly applied to the people of the nation of Israel. They're supposed to be a set apart people unto God, is the idea. By the way, here's an alternate rendering of the high priest's garments that was featured in some of our children's Bible classes recently. It's a little less detailed and ornate. Jeff Ogden and I both have had the pleasure of wearing that particular outfit in that class at different times. My wife really tried hard to get me to wear that today. And I almost gave in, but I just decided not to. Let's talk about, look at chapter 29. If you're in Exodus 29, I'm sorry, chapter 28. Granted that in any cultural or religious setting, when you've got a separate priesthood, they're usually wearing special garments that mark them off as a unique caste, a unique class or role of people. But God says a couple of things about the garments the priests, the high priest and the priests generally were to wear. Regarding the high priest's garments in particular, in verse 35 of chapter 28, his wearing them as he ministers is so that he will not die. Well, that sounds pretty important, does it not? And then verse 39, that they, the consecrated things, may be accepted before the Lord. And there's a lot of detail, which we're not taking time to look at in detail today. A lot of detail about when these garments were going to be put on. Interesting thing is, on the Day of Atonement was the day the priest wore not the full high priestly regalia, but just the ordinary white tunic that all the priests wore. As if to say, I'm a sinful person in need of God's redemption like everybody else. So that's an interesting feature when we get to Leviticus 16. Just be watching for that. But just the instructions God gives these priests are to be taken seriously to the degree that he says, you know, you'll die if you don't do these things the way I have said for them to be done. Why would God say that? Well, what are the priests doing in there in the tabernacle? They're interceding for the people. The priests going into the holy place on a day in and day out basis are ministering very near to where the symbol of the very presence of God was. And when the high priest went into the Holy of Holies on that Day of Atonement, he's going into what was the very presence of God above the mercy seat. So they needed to take very seriously everything about those responsibilities, including If God said you need to dress in a certain way to, you know, to do this, then that was to be done. Again, lots of elaborate details about what the high priest's garments involved. Look at this in chapter 29. Chapter 29, verse 29. The holy garments of Aaron shall be for his sons after him, that in them they may be anointed and ordained. He's talking about the succession of the high priesthood following Aaron. For 7 days, the one of his sons who is priest in his stead shall put them on when he enters the tent of meeting to minister in the holy place. And then down to verse 43, these special garments were to be on Aaron and on his sons when they enter the tent of meeting or when they approach the altar to minister to the holy place so that they do not incur guilt and die. It shall be a statute forever to him and his descendants after him. And that's about all we're going to say about the priest's garments today, because we got some other things we need to talk about along the way. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 7. While we're turning there, if you've got any questions or comments up to this point, go ahead and let me hear them as you're turning to Hebrews chapter 7. We're going to look at a couple of things there. We will look in more detail at the sacrificial system and particularly things connected to the Day of Atonement, and we'll come back to some of these same ideas in the book of Hebrews, but we just kind of want to hit them generally now. So let's look at Hebrews chapter 7. And I just ask you to, you know, kind of summarize what does the writer of Hebrews say about the priesthood in this chapter in different sections of it. So we look first at chapter 7, starting in verse 11 down through verse 16. We've looked at this before, actually, but we're gonna hit it again. Somebody just summarize what the writer of Hebrews tells us, just there in verses 11 to 16, what he tells us about the Old Testament priesthood. And here's the question I want us to answer first. Is the Old Testament priesthood under Moses the ultimate solution to man's spiritual need? No. That's what the Hebrew writer is emphasizing. There is a greater solution to which it points and of which it is a foreshadowing. There's a lot of similarities. And so that's what he highlights. So here in verses 11 and 16, give me a summary of what he emphasizes. Rather than having you read it, although maybe we should do that, but go ahead, Lamar.
The priest under Moses and dispensational perfect, there would be no need for another high priest.
Okay. All right. That's one thing. If perfection came through the Levitical priesthood, what further need was there for another priest? One of the core arguments of Hebrews is that who is our high priest under the new covenant? It's Jesus Christ. Remember, he's writing to people who grew up under the Mosaic system, including the priesthood. Now, they lived in the temple era, not the tabernacle era, but you know, a lot of the same ordinances. If perfection came through the Levitical priesthood, he says, then why do we need another one, another high priest? A high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. And that's one of the emphasis, one of the things that emphasized in the book of Hebrews. Jesus is like Melchizedek. Somebody remind us, who was Melchizedek? Okay. Where do we meet Melchizedek? What book do we meet him in? It's in Genesis. Abraham encounters this man named Melchizedek after Abraham's victory over the coalition of kings that came against Sodom. And Melchizedek is described as two things: the king of Salem, which is the city that later becomes Jerusalem. King of Salem, what else was he? He was a priest. Priest of the Most High God. Now, the Mosaic system didn't exist yet. Moses hadn't been born yet. So this man, in a local sense, was a priest of God. Moses' father-in-law Jethro was the priest of Midian. So you have evidently in the patriarchal era, in these localized priestly functions of certain men, we're not told a great deal about that. But Melchizedek was king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, and the Hebrew writer really emphasizes, Melchizedek just kind of comes out of nowhere into the narrative, and Abraham offers tithes to him, in recognition of his status as a priest of God. There's no genealogy of Melchizedek, there's no family history, none of that kind of thing. He just comes into the narrative and then leaves the narrative. And the Hebrew writer kind of latches onto that. Jesus is not a priest by virtue of birth, by virtue of his physical lineage. In fact, the Hebrew writer is gonna say he didn't come from the right tribe to be that under the law of Moses. So verse 12, when the priesthood has changed, what does that mean has also necessarily changed? According to verse 12 of Hebrews 7. The law. This is such an important verse. If we accept the fact that Jesus is our high priest, then we must logically accept the fact that the law of Moses is no longer in effect. Something has changed with regard to that, because Jesus wouldn't have been qualified to be a high priest under the Mosaic law. And that's what verses 13 and 14 are. The one could remember about this during our authority studies when we were talking about the silence of Scripture. We were talking about allowing the Scriptures when they're specific, that excludes other alternatives. Verse 13, the one concerning whom these things are spoken, Jesus, belongs to another tribe from whom no one is officiated at the altar, for it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, a tribe with reference to which Moses spoke nothing concerning priests. And again, this is clear still. If another priest arises according to the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become such not on the basis of a law, but a physical requirement, but according to the power of an indestructible life. New high priest, therefore, new law, new covenant. How about, skip down to verses 23 to 25 in Hebrews 7. What's the contrast that he gives here? Okay, all right. I mean, once the priest died, his job was over. We'll see in Leviticus there's actually a retirement system for the priest, but the high priest's role seems to have been for life. Once he had died, somebody else had to take over. And we look very briefly Exodus 28:29, talk just a little bit about the high priestly succession and consecration of the new priest and those kinds of things. And so you have throughout Mosaic history a multitude of people serving in the priestly office, because people die. How many priests do we have under the new covenant? Just the one. So verse 23, the former priests on the one hand existed in greater numbers because they were prevented by death from continuing. But Jesus, on the other hand, because he continues forever, holds his priesthood permanently. Therefore, he is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. This is, again, one of the disadvantages of the Old Testament priesthood is that those guys are ordinary mortal men. As important a role as they were dedicated to, they couldn't do it forever because they wouldn't live forever. Jesus does. Jesus always is there interceding for us, the writer of Hebrews says. And then the end of the chapter, verses 26 through 28, what does the writer of Hebrews emphasize there? Okay, all right. Mike, you had something? Okay, all right. When we talk about the men who served as priests, and especially the men who served as the high priest of Israel, were they flawless and perfect in their conduct? They weren't. And the Hebrew writer says, that's a basic point of inferiority with regard to the law, because these men had sins of their own that needed to be cleansed. They served an important function in cleansing and atoning for the sins of all the people. But what we'll see on the Day of Atonement, when we get to Leviticus 16, is that the high priest also had to make atonement for his own sins. And he had to do that every single year on the Day of Atonement, because he didn't live a sinless life. Jesus, on the other hand, verse 26, it was fitting for us to have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners and exalted above the heavens, who does not need, and here he talks about the daily sacrifices, which we're going to talk about in just a minute, who does not need daily, like those high priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people, because he did this how many times?
Once.
Really important biblical expression. One time for all time. Okay. Just like when Jude says the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints, it's pretty much the same expression here. Jesus offered himself once for all when he offered up not an animal sacrifice, but himself. So you've got, again, we highlighted this Wednesday, not only a superior priest, but a superior sacrifice. Verse 28, for the law appoints men as high priests who are weak, but the word of the oath, which came after the law, appoints a son made perfect forever. By the way, that word of the oath that he's talking about goes back to the Psalms. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. He quotes that in verse 17 and again in verse 21. I know for most of us who are Bible students, that's pretty basic stuff. Just be impressed with the contrast that the writer of Hebrews, just in this the second half of one chapter, draws between the admittedly exalted and very important role of Aaron and his successors as high priests in Israel, and what Jesus has done and continues to do. He offered one sacrifice, perfect, one time for all time, and he continues to mediate. Here we are almost 2,000 years after that sacrifice was offered, and Jesus is still in the presence of God, in the presence of the Father, serving as a mediator on our behalf. All right, questions or comments or anything? Let's go back to Exodus 29. Let's go down to question number 4. This is Exodus 29, verse 38. One of the things I'm going to ask you to think about, particularly as we go forward and look at the sacrificial system, is how busy the priests were on a daily basis and what they did on a daily basis at the tabernacle and then later at the temple. So, for example, here in chapter 29, verses 38 to 42, what offerings were to be made every day at the tabernacle? Okay. First of all, two lambs, two one-year-old lambs, one at the morning and the other at twilight. That's verses 38 and 39. Okay, what else?
Drink offering both times and a grain offering.
Okay, all right. You have a grain offering and a drink offering offered along with each of those lambs. Flour, oil, and flour and oil for a grain offering, wine for a drink offering. That's verses 40 and 41. Every morning and every evening, these were the regular sacrifices that were offered. And they are, how are they described in verse 41? A soothing or pleasing aroma, an offering to the Lord. It's a very important expression. You're going to see it. You're going to see it a lot in the book of Leviticus that focuses a lot, especially those first six or seven chapters, on the sacrifices that are offered. And verse 42 says this was to be done in perpetuity among the Israelites. Every day from now until, under the law of Moses, this is to be done. And it is going to be a soothing aroma or a pleasing fragrance, an offering by fire to the Lord. You see that, again, multiple times in Exodus, many, many times in Leviticus. I want to go over to Ephesians chapter 5. I didn't ask you this one in particular, but Ephesians chapter 5. We will see other occasions when lambs are going to be offered as sacrifices. We're going to see other occasions when grain offerings and drink offerings are presented by individual people. We'll look at that in Leviticus. But these were, think of these as the regular daily communal sacrifices that were offered. Each morning, a lamb, a grain offering, a drink offering. Each evening, a lamb, a grain offering, a drink offering. Here's Ephesians chapter 5. Can I get somebody to read in Ephesians 5 verses 1 and 2? Ephesians 5, 1 and 2. Got that, Ernie? Got it? Go ahead.
Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you, and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma.
Okay. Paul doesn't just pull that expression out of nowhere. What does he say here is for these Ephesian Christians an offering and sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma? It's walking in love. Look also at just a few pages over in the Philippian letter in chapter 4. Chapter 4, we're going to read verse 18. Remember that Philippians is written to the Philippian church by Paul from prison, and they have, on more than one occasion, sent relief. They have sent aid to Paul in his situation, and he's writing about that. Chapter 4, can I get somebody to read chapter 4 of Philippians, verse 18? Larry, go ahead. Okay, so here in this verse, what does Paul say is the fragrant aroma and a pleasing sacrifice? All right. It's the things that they have sent to Paul via Epaphroditus. Paul does this a lot. He borrows the Old Testament language of sacrifices and the priesthood, the offering of sacrifices, and applies it to all kinds of things, seemingly ordinary kinds of things that we do as Christians that are not taking an animal and slaughtering it and offering it as a burnt sacrifice. There are things like conducting ourselves in love toward one another or providing for the support of an evangelist in need. Romans chapter 12 and verse 1 calls on us to present our bodies as a living sacrifice that is holy. A lot of language of the priesthood that is used in that verse. Or think of 1 Timothy chapter, or 2 Timothy chapter 4, where Paul writes to Timothy from again from prison, evidently some of his last words, and he says, I am already being poured out as, you can finish the sentence, a drink offering. That doesn't come out of nowhere. You poured the drink out, offering out, you can't put it back in the vessel once it's been poured out on the ground. It's over. Paul says, that's where I am being poured out, I am being used up. There's going to be no more Paul on this earth. But I am being used up as an offering to God. Watch for that kind of language in the New Testament. It draws heavily on some of these Old Testament priestly and sacrifice images that we're looking at. Again,
Those are some of the daily sacrifices that are offered, the daily communal sacrifices. And then in addition to that, as we will see, you've got all through the day individual people bringing sacrifices to the tabernacle. I picture on some days a pretty long queue outside the entrance to the tabernacle courtyard of people with thank offerings and grain offerings and guilt offerings and sin offerings. We'll talk about all of that starting Wednesday when we look at Leviticus. When you add it all up, the priests were really busy all day. And they were busy in messy work because we're talking about slaughtering animals and sacrificing them. There is no way to do that neatly. So, you know, just think about, and again, I'll ask you to do this as we go through Leviticus. Picture the sights and the sounds and even the smells that would have been going on down at the tabernacle every single day that the Israelites are in this wilderness journey, and even after they settle in the land of Canaan. Even after the temple was built, there's still all the same things are going on at the temple. And I don't want to get ahead of myself because we're going to talk about this more, but I'm convinced all of that mess had to be a daily reminder to the people, you know what, none of this would be necessary except that we're sinful people serving a holy God. If it weren't for that, none of this would be needed. Keep that in mind. We'll talk more about that as we go along. Chapter 29 of Exodus, verse 43. Anybody got a... Do you have something, James? Go ahead. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. Okay. I don't know if you heard what James said. James did a little math trying to calculating. Now these are the communal sacrifices that are, you know, that are offered for the whole congregation of Israel day in and day out. It adds up. Two lambs a day. You know, that's over 700 a year. Thousands and thousands over the course of the decades. Great expense. And we haven't even gotten into the individual sacrifices and the cost to the individual that would have involved. Yes, even in a society where, you know, where people are raising sheep and goats right and left, there's an expense when you have to take one pretty regularly and offer it as a sacrifice. So that's another factor that figures into all of this. Is reminded the people of the cost of sin. And all of those things end up being excellent pointers to the price that's paid on the cross. Chapter 29, starting in verse 43, I just want us to read this about the purpose of the tabernacle and the priesthood. This is Exodus 29. Verse 43, God's talking about the tabernacle, and he says, I will meet there with the sons of Israel, and it shall be consecrated by my glory. I will consecrate the tent of meeting and the altar. I will also consecrate Aaron and his sons to minister as priests to me. I will dwell among the sons of Israel and will be their God. They shall know that I am the Lord their God who brought them out of the land of Egypt that I might dwell among them. I am the Lord their God. You know, when we, if we ask why this elaborate system of sacrifices and all the things connected to the tabernacle and all the things connected to the priesthood, God says Israel's going to know that I'm dwelling among them, that I'm the one who brought them out of Egypt. And I brought them out of Egypt so that I could be present among them. I didn't just bring them out of Egypt to move them to a new zip code. I brought them out of Egypt to establish a covenant with them and to be their God and for them to be my people. That's language that gets used in Exodus a lot, and it's language that gets adapted in the New Testament a lot. He is our God and we are his people. Let's go back to the book of Hebrews, this time to chapter 10. Remember, really, all we have looked at so far in, with regard to the sacrifices are the daily morning and evening communal sacrifices that were mandatory to be offered at the tabernacle. We haven't gotten into all the individual sacrifices yet. We've just hinted at that. There's a lot. Chapter 10 of Hebrews. Starting in verse 11, the writer of Hebrews, you notice the writer of Hebrews spends a lot of time talking about the Old Testament priesthood and the priesthood of Jesus. So here's Hebrews chapter 10, starting in verse 11. Every priest stands daily ministering and offering time after time the same sacrifices. We've already talked about that. What does he say about those sacrifices in verse 11? Why not? Okay. This is a big, you know, a key point in the book of Hebrews. All these animal sacrifices, in and of themselves, could not take away sin. Why? Mike hit on it. It's not an adequate substitute. Okay. The general instruction in the law is you sin. Then in recognition of and for cleansing from that sin, you bring an animal and sacrifice that. It's usually a lamb or a goat. There's all, you know, sometimes a bull, all these specifics. You bring that animal and sacrifice it. You are giving its life as atonement for yours. We're going to look at a passage in Leviticus as we go that just spells that out. The blood of the sacrificial animals is to make atonement on the altar for your lives. But we look at that and we think, well, there's one problem. Is there really an equivalent between that lamb on the altar and me? An equivalent in terms of intrinsic value? We look at that and no. Okay. Why? Well, because we're made in the image of God and the likeness of God. That's why. God has said He wants to have a relationship with us, not with the sheep. So, the Hebrew writer says, because of that, the blood of bulls and goats cannot take away sin. So, that's the end of verse 11. Those sacrifices can't take away sins. That doesn't mean they were unimportant. And please understand, that doesn't mean that for the Israelites, they were meaningless. God said to the Israelites, if you do these things, your sins will be taken away. What the writer of Hebrews tells us, we haven't read this part yet, the writer of Hebrews tells us is those sins were taken away because those sacrifices look forward to the great sacrifice. That and that alone is what enabled God to be able to say to the Israelites, your sins will be forgiven. But the animals in themselves weren't sufficient for that. There's a recognition. Sin requires sacrifice. Sin exacts a price. Okay, enough about that. Verse 12. But he, Jesus, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time onward until his enemies be made a footstool for his feet. For by one sacrifice, one offering, he has perfected for all time those who are sanctified. We already saw this contrast in chapter 7. Old Testament, priests offering sacrifices day in, day out, year in, year out, all the time. High priest dies, new high priest is anointed to take his place. He serves for however many years, he dies, another one comes along. And all this goes on day in, day out, year in and year out, all through. Sacrifice and high priesthood of Jesus. One sacrifice, perfect for all time, and an ongoing priesthood that never ends because it's an unending life. Go down to verse 16. This is the covenant that I will make with them after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws upon their heart, and on their mind I will write them. It's from Jeremiah. He then says, and their sins and their lawless deeds I will remember no more. Now, where there is forgiveness of these things, there is no longer
any offering for sin.
Once the real forgiveness in Christ came along, you don't have a need for the ongoing sacrifices of those animals anymore. Because the perfect sacrifice, you don't have a need for the types and shadows, the foreshadowings anymore, because the real thing has come along.
It's like, and we talked about this when we first talked about types and shadows. You're outside on a sunny day. You're standing by the corner of a building. You see the shadow of somebody approaching around the corner. What do you expect to see next?
The person that's casting the shadow. All right. Is the shadow the reality? No. It's an indicator of the reality. It tells you about what's coming in some level of detail, not very much, but you're anticipating the real thing coming around. That's what Hebrews is all about.
A couple of other things real quickly before we finish up. It's question number 7. In chapter 30, what was to be collected every time the people were numbered? Okay. As verse 12 describes it, each one of them shall give a ransom for himself to the Lord. That ransom was half a shekel for everyone 20 years and older, verses 13 and 14. It's also described in verses 15 and 16 as their way of making atonement for themselves. That requirement was universal. Verse 15, the rich shall not pay more, the poor shall not pay less than the half shekel. And it's going to be used, verse 16 says, for the service of the tent of the... This is a part of how the ongoing maintenance and upkeep of the tabernacle is funded, is by this regular half shekel offering. Just notice how God describes it. He describes it as an atonement. He describes it as a ransom. What's a ransom? Okay, all right. In very much the same way, we looked at, remember when we looked at the God's instruction about the firstborn, that certain firstborn animals were to be sacrificed and others were to be bought back. The firstborn male of each family was dedicated to the Lord and a sacrifice was offered in order to buy him back for the family, in essence. Similar language here. God says every individual offers this as a ransom for himself. It's an acknowledgement of God's ownership of the people of Israel in a way. I'm skipping down to chapter 40. You know this one without even having to look at it. After all of the things were done in the construction of the tabernacle, the consecration of the tabernacle, the consecration of the priesthood, how did God show his approval? Okay. All right. Verse 34 says, the cloud covered the tent of meeting and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So, you know, in a very significant way, God has shown, you've done what I asked. I am and will continue indeed to be among you as your God, and you'll be my people. Okay, we got one really important question we haven't got to yet. We're going to save this for later. I just want you to think about this as we go through Leviticus. Similarities between Moses and Christ. We've already talked about the priesthood. It fulfilled in Jesus. How is Moses like Jesus? We'll talk about that along the way as we get the opportunity. We'll start Leviticus Wednesday night. That's part 2 of our workbook. Please be sure you pick that up before you leave, or you can download it from the website, and we'll start there with lesson number 12 on Wednesday.